Hi, and welcome to the Just Riding Along show.
Hello, and welcome to episode 238. Tonight's show is brought to you by...
Chickens.
Yeah, chickens. Chicken nuggets.
Chicken nuggets.
So, what we normally do is, since I'm already talking, I go first. And this week I went and did a moto trials competition. And it went really well. There is a really cool family in Cotopaxi, which is just like a 30-minute drive from here. And they allow us to host a two-day event on private property. It's not always a two-day event, but this was a two-day event. And I camped there because even though it's not far, all my friends were there. So I got to experience a few really cool things. One was how to ride with your brake foot peg pedal thing, your foot lever. I don't know what the fuck it's called.
Your foot brake pedal?
Your foot brake pedal folded over at like 90 degrees. That happened on like section 4 on the first day on the first loop. So I rode what, like 56 more sections with that in the way. And then later I bent my handbrake lever and got to ride a bunch of sections like that.
You should, before you replace it, you should try to straighten it and see what happens.
Oh, I know what's going to happen.
Probably.
I know what's going to happen. And if it doesn't happen then, it happens the next time it gets like looked at wrong by a stick or a rock.
I was just riding along.
Yeah, I get it. But things went well. There is a guy that consistently beats me, and he beat me. And I did pretty well outside of that.
He didn't beat you by as much as he usually does.
Exactly. And better than that, a 12-year-old from New Mexico showed up and just stomped our faces in. It was amazing. he was riding an 80cc bike and just giving her hell. And it was cool. So glad they came up. Rode some stuff I didn't think I could ride. I hopped some stuff. God, full face Ray Ray is gonna listen to this. I had my most spectacular and nearly lost it like 19 times in once in one section, and it happened to be the section he was scoring, and it was pretty amazing. Yeah, I think I have a video of it. I'll send someone eventually, but anyways, still have my remaining testicle. Didn't lose a nut, which is always good. And that's really my week.
I think you should mention what the people watching that section said in the background of the video.
No, those were different sections.
Oh, okay.
So this was a very atypical trial. And the thing is Saturday had a lot of like pretty big stuff in it. Big in the sense of like it was a lot of stuff took some ambition or took some
commitment.
Some commitment. And really on Sunday, like everything was just weird. Awful, janky, just goofy stuff. And it was really fun because it was all really, like, the Saturday was hard because some of the stuff was big. Sunday was hard because all of it was so fucking tight and jumbly and just, you had to have your wheel right where it was supposed to be. Like, on Sunday, there was two sections. One of the sections, in order to properly do the turn, you had to keep your front wheel outside of this rock. And your rear wheel was going to be inside of the rock as you like went through the corner. And if you got off, like if you tried to go inside of the rock, you wouldn't be set up for the corner. If you tried to go outside of the rock, you would have blown the tape. And then another one had like a stump that was probably like, I don't know, maybe a little smaller than the size of like a, it was like the size of a regular Red Bull can. And it was just in the way if you let it be. And it was just really cool. But one of the sections was, no joke, it barely had a turn in it. You went up this hill. That was on Saturday. You went up this hill, and you turned about 45, 60 degrees at the top and went up two steps. I never cleaned that section. And the first time I looked at it, I was like, I'm just going to go like hell. Like, I don't know, because this is private property. It doesn't get ridden a lot, so everything is loose. Or like at Turkey Rock, where we ride all the time, all the loose stuff has been chewed out and you end up with a lot of really hard pack, or you end up with not a lot of like stone and brick sized rocks and stuff in it. And I was like, I don't really know how to tackle this. So second gear, wide open. Let's see how it goes. And I gave her hell, and my buddy was recording. And it turns out that someone in the background said, man, it takes balls to go that fast. And someone else piped up, I think that's the guy with just one ball left. And it's just hilarious. So, yeah, it was a really good weekend. I got to see some people I haven't seen in a while. Got to do some cool things. And really, it's not just the brake lever issue, but, like, my bike is getting older. And it's getting harder to find some, like, parts for. And obviously, I rode it all weekend, and I could probably replace the brake issue stuff for $250 because I maybe a little bit more. No, maybe a good bit more. I don't know if I can get brake levers for those brakes because GasGas used that brake for one season. I've already replaced the rear brake because it failed. The front brake works, but I don't know if I can get a replacement lever for it. And that bike kind of needs a shock, and it kind of needs a bunch of, like, little stuff. And I think I'm just going to buy a new GasGas Trials bike this weekend. So KTM, as many people know, went through some issues. And one of the things that got them in issues is they made every KTM dealer take GasGas Trials bikes last year. And most dealers have no desire to have a Trials bike, but they had to take them, and they haven't moved them. And there's bikes with like a $9,500 retail on sale for $53. And I'm like, I can drive a few hours and save $4,000. So
yeah, I mean, you need to do that clearly.
Yeah, I know. I am kind of beating them up on price still. It's a dickhead thing, but I'm just.
Can you like talk to them already?
You mean talk to them finally?
Yeah.
Call. Today is Thursday. They're closed on Mondays. I called Tuesday, left a message. Called Wednesday, left a message. Called Thursday and was like, because I know the KTM Colorado sales manager. He told me who to call. I called that person and left two voicemails. Never heard back. I then called and was like, I just need to talk to anyone in sales. And I was on hold so long that the receptionist had to put me on hold twice more. And then the guy finally answers the phone. And when trying to tell him what I wanted, he didn't know what he had for sale. It's just so confusing. So I am being a little bit of a jerk here, but turns out it's really hard to give people money if they won't call you and confirm that they have products and tell you what kind of ridiculous dealer fees or whatever. Because it may be one of those things where, like, yeah, they're $5,300 with a $2,700 dealer fee. Go fuck yourself. I'm not going to buy that. But anyways, I just tried to beat him up on price a little bit. Because he told me the price. And I'm like, no, I need the out-the-door price. Like, I need to know how big of a check can I bring you and take this motorcycle home. And then I literally said to him on the phone, I was like, can I show up with a personal check and take this motorcycle home? He's like, absolutely. I was like, I live a few hours away. With road conditions, I'm probably going to want to pull a front wheel, and I'll need a hand loading it under the topper in my pickup truck so I can get it home without my brand new bike being blasted. I was like, but honestly, that's all that I'm going to ask. Like, I might pick up an air filter if you have it, or fork guards or whatever. I was like, but that would be just normal shopping. I was like, I'll just show up, hand you a check, sign it, put it in the truck, then browse around the store. I was like, I want this. And he's like, okay. And I was like, just get me an out-the-door price. And he texted me back, not an out-the-door price. And I'm like, just tell me how much money to bring you, and I'll take this home. Anyways, because I do work in retail, I have really high standards for other people that work in retail, and I shouldn't because they're other people. I think I'm done talking. Kenny, it's your turn.
All right. Surprise, surprise. I rode some moto. I did a whole bunch of stuff to the bike last week. I did tires, and I talked about it, I think, on the last show, but tires and grips and oil change and filter change, like air filter. And what else did I do? Fixed some lights that were broken on it. Just a whole bunch of stuff. Put a new exhaust on it. And yeah.
Does it sound cooler?
Yeah, I didn't do it for the sound. I actually don't want it to be any louder, but it is, even though I modified the stock exhaust, it was still choked out a little bit, and I've got a tune on it. And it was still a little bit hesitant off the bottom. It actually screamed pretty good on the top. But now it has, it's way more open at the bottom. It's kind of like opposite of what you would think. It really doesn't scream any harder up top. Maybe a little bit, like maybe a horsepower, but it feels way torqueier down low. So yeah, overall, I think pretty good. And the noise is tolerable. It's just it's a long story, but it's just an end cap that you put on the factory exhaust and you got out some other stuff. It's still got spark arrestor and it's legal and all that jazz. Anyway, did that. I went to just did some exploring. I did a 2-day, went out on Saturday morning, found a spot. I thought it was where I wanted to be, but it wasn't. So I rode around for like an hour and I was like, yep, this is not really where I want to be. So I packed it back up in the car, drove another like 20 minutes, found a much cooler spot, hopped out, rode for like another 2 hours and found a really good camping spot. And in that first day at the second place, and by the way, I'm over there in the Goblin Valley area. For those that are curious, you can go look that up. It's off Highway 24, get off 70. And I ended up in a giant wash, and it's like that pea gravel stuff. And that stuff's nastier than sand by a long shot, because you just, I mean, it's like it's a foot deep. It's a foot deep, and it doesn't matter what tire you have on your motorcycle. If it wants to put you on the ground, it will.
You need a hovercraft.
Yeah, pretty much. So anyway, I had some fun doing that, and it had a lot of moves in it where it was like, you know, tight between boulders and step ups and step downs and just semi-techie riding. And I got way deep in this thing, and it just showed it that it's a BLM road. And it's definitely not a BLM road, so I don't know who the fuck marked that, because it was just a creek bed. And it was for miles of like techie riding. And I was enjoying myself, but I was also like, it's getting later in the day. I'm starting to lose some sunlight. I'm getting pretty freaking tired. I'm like sweating my ass off, you know, just working hard. And I'm getting really deep in here. And now I'm starting to think like, okay, if this doesn't cut through, this is going to suck. Like, I'll be fine. Like, I'm prepared. I have like an extra helmet light. I've got a good headlight on the motorcycle. But I would have ridden out in the dark, and I would have had to go backtrack all the shit that I did. It would have taken me like an hour to get out, probably. And sure enough, I got to a spot, and it was on the map. It shows that it kept going, but it was just literally a dead end, like a cliff. So I was like, well, shit, that's not good. So luckily, I was able to backtrack maybe 15 minutes, and then I kind of did double risk. It was another wash that went north, but then connected to a gravel road. And I was like, well, fuck. I'm just going to go for this, and hopefully this cuts through. It's either going to be 30 more minutes or it's going to be 2 hours if I fuck up. And luckily it was 30 more minutes, maybe less than that. But I found my way out to the gravel road, kind of got back to the car at sunset, set up my tent for the first time. I got a bed style tent for the Ridgy, and it was a risk because I had never set the thing up before and I didn't even know if it fit the car, and it's not made for the car. It's made for like other quarter tons that have like flat rails and
like a Chevy Avalanche or something.
Yeah, it's not for an Avalanche. It's made for like a Ford. It's made for a 5-foot Tacoma. Like, it's made for a normal Tacoma or like a Colorado, that kind of stuff. And I have a 5-foot bed, so it's like the same as a short bed Tacoma. But anyway, it's got all kinds of weird Honda curves on it and shit. So, and it's also just a pain in the ass to set this tent up. Like, it's not, you really got to set it up on the ground, which is what I did. And then like try to heave it in the back and then tie it down to the vehicle. And so I'm doing this, and it's definitely like, now it's dark.
I was going to say, longer than you wanted. You're tired, probably a little bonky, and you're trying to set this tent up.
Oh no, the air fryer was running. He had nuggets and mozzarella sticks.
Yeah, I mean, I had a pizza going in the air fryer for sure. And I was drinking a beer. Like, I was relaxed. I wasn't that worried about it. Also, if it pissed me off much more than it did, I would have just cowboy camped in the back because it was 50 degrees. It was fine. I would have just thrown the big ass foam trifold mattress that I have. It weighs like 40 pounds. And it's super comfy. Like, it's an actual bed mattress that I bring with me. And so I could just throw that in the back of the truck. That's what I did what we talked about on the last show, and it was fine. But anyway, finally got the tent set up. It's a little bit fiddly to get going, and it doesn't fit like quite flush on there. But when you're inside the tent, it's super spacious. Like, you can stand up back there, which is pretty cool. And it actually looks fine and normal inside the tent. But if you look outside, it looks like all cattywampus because it doesn't sit flush. But whatever, I don't care. I don't care what people think my camp setup looks like.
You should just drive it around like that.
I think it would remove itself very quickly. But it was comfy. It was 50 degrees out, super nice. Just slept under a light blanket on my super nice, I don't know what you call it, memory foam mattress. And yeah, it was great. And woke up and rode a bunch of more stuff in that area. But I was able to do a little bit longer, more focused ride. And I was going to go to that kind of 5 mile of hell area because I was right next to it. And I was going to go just explore around there and poke around. But probably 30 minutes into the ride, as happens a lot of times, I just stumbled across a single track trail. And I'm looking at my Garmin all the time. And I see this trail. And I definitely thought, I got the vibe that it was a hiking trail. And when I first pulled up to it, it looked like a hiking trail, the way they had it like all blocked off, like where you definitely aren't getting a vehicle in it. And turns out it's a moto trail. And you could hike it if you wanted to. But it was like a 20 mile out and back. I say out and back, it's kind of an out and back. You can't really make a complete loop on the trail, but you could loop it out using like gravel roads. You'd add another 5 miles or something. But it was a roughly 15 mile, 20 mile, something like that, single track route. I didn't know what it was, so I definitely just dipped my toe in, and it was like, had some techie moves in the beginning, and I didn't want to get in to something super rowdy. And it turns out that there are zero ways in or out of this thing. There's not a single gravel road, no access, no nothing. Didn't realize that until I was about halfway through it. And I think it's a fairly famous trail called the Waterfall Trail. I think they've done a couple of YouTubers have done stuff out there, I think. But halfway through, it's got that big old poster that's drilled into a huge boulder at a lookout spot. And it's the pictorial story of this guy in 2004 who tried to take like a Honda XL 175 or something on this trail. That's definitely like a enduro dirt bike trail. And he got stuck and he had to get it airlifted out. And he left, I don't know if he left it or someone else left it. But it's a big picture thing of like, hey, it's a really bad idea to bring a 1973 Honda XL 175 on this trail. Airlifts are very expensive. And it's a picture of his old Honda with a giant cable on it being airlifted out by a helicopter.
That's kind of like in Moab, the Portal Trail. It's a mountain bike, and I mean, you could hike it too. And you get to one spot, and it's like, stop, walk your bike. People have...
There's a bunch of people have died.
Yeah. I mean, there's like one rock move that, you know, like if you were just riding it on flat ground, you might like try it a couple of times and eventually make it. But like, if you don't make it...
Where you put your foot down is 500 feet down.
Yeah, exactly. Like if you don't make it, you do not make it ever.
Yep. But it was kind of fun because I was exploring this trail. I'm like, man, this is pretty cool. It had flowy spots. It had tech spots. It was open desert. It was like rocky. It had a little bit of everything. And I'm just kind of in the flow, enjoying myself. And there were a couple moves that I had to kind of like, again, I'm solo. I'm by myself and I don't know this trail. So I'm being cautious and making sure like, hey, even though it's fun, like don't just blindly take a 5 foot drop, because if you do that, you might realize that later on down, you got to turn around and then you can't fucking turn around. So I'm being cautious. And then I get that halfway mark and I see that thing and I'm like, oh, it's that trail. I was like, oh, shit. And there's a huge move after that. And I think I went accidentally like the hard direction. It was still definitely very doable. But the huge move up, I just glanced at it from afar. Like you could see it going up. If you've ever been to like Moab and the drop in at Mineral Basin, Mineral Bottom, I think that's the one. And maybe it's the opposite end of that, of the White Rim Trail. But anyway, you can look out and see just this road switchbacking, snaking up like the side of the rock mountain. It was the same thing of this, except it was really just one turn. But you could see it was just incredibly off camber. And you can see all like the rubber marks on the rocks and it's huge exposure out to one side. I'm just like, nope, not solo, not happening. And maybe it's fine. I literally didn't even ride up to it. There was just a bypass around it that was way more tame. So I just did that. But anyway, it was a fun trip. Rode some new stuff. There's just so much Utah dirt biking stuff to do. It's out of control. I talk about it on every show. I mean, I've been so many places and there's just still tons more. It's absolutely insane. So I had a really good time. The moto behaved perfectly. Everything was great. Yeah, camping was good. Ridgy was good. And I think we're going to go out again this weekend. And I might join up with some people. It's kind of tentative. We'll see. Might go to Moab. Some buddies got some new ADV bikes. And they're going to go try those out and camp in a spot. And I might join up and kind of do semi my own thing, but kind of camp with them. So, yeah, Matt, if you want to get in the car, come on out to Moab.
We'll see. Probably not. I'm going to try to secure a new trials bike this weekend. But
oh, yeah. Okay. Excellent.
But one thing I forgot to mention is I ordered my swag tent last year and then lost a nut and didn't get to use it. And I got to sleep in it for the first time this weekend. And it was pretty, pretty dope. It works. You set it up in like 2 minutes and you hop inside. And it was the day after a full moon. We had really clear skies. And the only issue that I had is pretty cold overnight. Like there was frost on the cars in the morning. Only issue I ran into is I may have only zipped the bug net, not the canvas fly, when I got inside. So at some point I woke up pretty cold and I was like, I gotta pee. And then I went to get out and like I unzipped. And I was like, wait, that was the thing. And I started looking for the other zipper and like 2 feet of it was still open. And I was like, that's why it was chilly. And I took a leak and I zipped myself in there properly and went back to sleep all warm and cozy. And it's dope.
You know, this is something I'm still like, I don't know, experimenting with a little bit when I camp in the truck. Is that if you close it all the way up and it's like kind of mid temperature, like, I don't know, like, he's, like, pretty cold, but, you know, around freezing, but not, like, just frigid. If you don't leave a window, like, it's going to be pretty close to the outside temperature inside the truck after a couple of hours. And if you have a window open, it just gets colder. It gets that temperature faster, but it doesn't get humid. And it's definitely, I've had some times, like, when I first started camping in the truck that, yeah, I would just close all the windows because it was cold outside and then wake up in the morning and it's like the whole inside of the truck is like there's condensation that has like frozen on the inside of the windows and it's colder.
Yeah, you want that airflow for sure.
Yeah, like it's colder feeling inside the truck and like you get out of the truck and it actually feels warmer. And so I pretty much, unless it's like low 20s, like really getting into the 20s, I leave the windows cracked because it's going to be that cold. It's either going to be that cold and humid or it's going to be that cold and dry.
Well, yeah. Anyway, there are different ways, different places.
What's that tent called again?
It is the 230 Dual Swag, I think. But there's...
Gotcha. And like, what does it do? Like, what makes it what it is?
So a swag is wax canvas and it is, oh, it's the Dual 900. I was looking it up. It is wax canvas and it's got a probably 1¾-inch memory foam and it just stays in there. Like you roll it up.
So the foam, the base / bed, whatever you want to call it, the floor that is squishy is built in. Is that really what makes a swag tent?
It's the shape, the size. And so it's not built in, it's just included. Like you can take it out to like clean stuff, but it is just really, it's really small, compact. Like it rolls up to about the size of a small, like, I don't know, it would easily fit in like a shop trash can. And
I guess in retrospect, I probably should have gotten one of these because one of these can still just go in the bed of your truck.
Totally. Yeah.
But you just do that and then it's done.
Yeah, and like what I did is I, like this, you can open either side, and it,
you got the 900?
Yeah, and you can open, what I should have done is staked out the head and the foot flies, and opened the foot fly a lot, and the head fly a little bit. I just had like 2 feet open, like right by my face, and my face isn't covered up. So, yes, I agree there would be better ways to, like, vent it. And venting it is better than just being in, like, a little sauna of coldness. But what I did is I literally, when I woke up in the morning, I threw the can, like, I unzipped one side all the way and threw the canvas flap, like, up over the top and then closed up the bug net. And I went and rode. And when I was done riding during, like, the changeover of class to, like, uppers and lowers, before I went out and scored, I, like, grabbed my stuff out of there and threw it in the truck. And I folded it up and rolled it up and dropped it in. And, like, one of the dudes was so stoked. He's like, man, I'm going to buy one of these for my... He has, like, a toy hauler RV. He's like, this would be so cool because, you know, I could just have, like, an extra bedroom. You know, when someone, like, joins me on a trip, they don't have to sleep inside with, like, me and my wife, like, on the little... You know, we don't have to, like, set up the little kitchen table bed. We can just toss them in, like, the yard. And then in the morning, they have all the amenities of a camper, and they're hanging out with us, but they don't have to, like, sleep inside with us. And he's like, this old dude, he's crazy. He's amazing. I love him to death. And he's like, I need to take some pictures of this so I won't forget. But, yeah, these things are really cool, man. And, like, they do sell a cot kit that's, like, the right size so you can set up your swag on a cot. And then when you get out of it, you're, like, in a seated position. You don't have to, like, crawl out on the ground. But I took a scrap of carpet, so I set my swag up, like, on the ground, but there was carpet beside the swag, like, kind of tucked underneath it. So I didn't, like... Like, I wiped my feet on the carpet and then got inside and, like, set my... I have old house slippers that are now my camping slippers, and I set those, like, at the foot of the swag. I don't know. This thing's dope. And
I'm looking at that 1550. I want one you can, like, stand up four people in.
What are you doing with four people in your swag? Oh, my God. That thing would be so heavy,
dude.
Called
the Outbreak.
Jesus Christ. What would you do with that?
Sleep in that thing.
With your air fryer?
Yeah, 49 pounds. That's less than my mattress.
Dude. So I will say the mattress, when I, like, I can't sleep with socks on. It's just, it's illegal. But anyways, I took my socks off. And when I was doing that, I could, like, feel my sit bones on the earth. But as soon as you lay down, the pad is definitely, like, just the right thickness that when, you know, almost 200 pound man is lying on it. Backside doesn't matter. Like, my hip wouldn't touch the ground.
I would recommend
That's not going to work. I need an eight inch thick mattress.
Yeah, I was going to say, if you do have to camp in that when it's really cold, take an extra pad of some sort with, even if you just put, like, an old yoga mat under it or something, just to give you a little bit more ground insulation, because that makes a big difference in cold comfort if you are nowhere close to the ground.
I know, but it has, like, a nylon, like, bathtub.
I know. I'm just saying that that's not very insulating. Look, I've spent a lot of nights outside.
And what I'm trying to say is my piece of carpet was wide enough that it was under most of my mattress, and I still had, like, a floor mat, and I still had, like, I was only cold because there was wind blowing on my face.
Okay. Well, you'll learn. He'll learn eventually.
I mean, it was like in the 20s if it got frosty, so.
Maybe.
Whatever. All right,
is it my turn now?
Yeah, because obviously I don't know how to sleep outside and Andrea knows everything. It's your turn.
Whatever. Anyway, I haven't done a whole lot. So over the winter, I found kind of this area to mountain lion, where I went to mountain lion hunt a couple of times, and it's all public land, but you have to cross the Arkansas River to get to it. Or you have to drive a really long way, and when you get out of your car, you would have to, like, you'd be at, like, the top of this area a couple of miles up. And I don't know, anyone who's done a lot of outdoor stuff, you know that, like, it's really nice to start your day at the lowest elevation. That way you don't have to end your day with hiking or riding or whatever it is up to where you started. It's very nice when you're tired. You have to park, walk down the highway, maybe, like, I don't know, 200 or 300 yards, and go in through, like, this one little square of public land, cross the river, and then you're in this just vast kind of system of, like, these, like, little shallow drainages and stuff. And it's really, really cool, but no one goes in there because you have to cross the river to get there. So, like, you have to take waders. You might be able to make it with like hip waders, but I just have full length waders and it's like mid thigh deep in a couple of spots. So yeah, like it's a legitimate river crossing. It's got some current and you kind of have to pick your way across a couple of little islands, and yeah, it's just a wide spot in the river. So it's not like the easiest place to get to. So no one goes there. I mean, like I've found cans, like old cans and stuff, and they pretty much just like the pull tab on them tells me that the last time anyone really spent much time in there was probably when the railroad was active, because the railroad here that's closed down now, I don't remember what year it closed in, but it used to have kind of like a service road along it, and I think people used to drive kind of to that area and probably go in there and hunt and whatever, but no one goes in there now. And when I was hunting back over the winter, so in Colorado, you can't pick up shed antlers between, I think it's January 1st and May 1st.
Refer to your local CPW office guidelines. Do not take us as legal advice.
Yeah, I mean, I'm pretty sure those are the dates, but so you can't pick up shed antlers, and it's because like elk sheds are actually worth some money if you have like nice large ones that haven't been like chewed on by rodents and stuff that are pretty fresh. And people will go into these areas where animals like to spend the winter, and while it is legal to go hike or hunt or whatever, you can't pick up shed antlers, but it's to keep people that are really like collecting them from just going into these areas and making the animals run around more than usual. I even had someone messaged me on Instagram and he said, yeah, I've heard people talking about how they would like chase a herd of elk on their snowmobiles hoping that antlers would fall off. And in the wintertime, animals, they're pretty much starving. Like they're just kind of living off of their stored summer fat, and they browse on like whatever they can, but you know, there's not a lot of calories for them. You know, a couple of people pushing them around like that could mean the difference between them living and dying over the wintertime. So they don't let you pick up shed antlers. So I went back once, you know, it was allowed, and I had marked where I'd seen like some cool deadheads and sheds and stuff, and just went back and kind of retraced my steps that I'd gone over the wintertime and picked up, I think, like 3 or 4 mule deer deadheads. So that's another thing, like these winter areas where there's not a lot of people, like that's like the old and kind of sick animals. They just die there because it's wintertime and they're starving, and if there's anything wrong with them at all, there's a good chance they're just going to die. And so there's a bunch of them. And so I went and picked up a few deadheads and some big elk sheds that I'd found, and just came back out with a backpack full of antlers, which was really cool. Like some are really nice, some aren't quite as nice, but I like to collect that stuff and just have like a corner of the yard that's just a bunch of like bones and skulls and stuff. And I did that. And then today I went and hiked around a little more. Didn't find any sheds, but I found a cool old mine. And when I got back home, I went to check on the chickens. And I've got, I think I talked about it before, a hen that's broody. She's sitting on some eggs. And I looked in there, didn't see anything, but I'd set up. We got some snow the last couple of days, and it's all melting off now, but I had put like a tarp in front of her little maternity ward area and put a have these ceramic heat lamps. It's not really a lamp because there's no light. It's just a ceramic thing that's shaped kind of like a light that just gets warm. And I'd put that in there because, you know, she's not really moving around much. I didn't want her water to freeze and everything. So went in there to check on her and unplug the lamp because it's nice and warm now. And I hear little peep peeps. And I poked my head in there and she immediately like did a mama chicken growl at me, which is a really funny noise. And I was like, oh yeah, there's definitely some babies in there. And I reached in there and she pecked me a lot. And I lifted her up and there's a couple little babies running around. And so hopefully she'll hatch a couple more and we'll have a few extra chickens. And yeah, that's kind of it for me. Kind of a low-key week. Shall we move to new shit?
What you got, Kenny?
I guess Specialized changed pricing in a huge way on all Levos.
How'd they change
it? That's like really big news. They came down in price a lot. I think they're a little bit concerned about competition, is my educated guess. It's very controversial. Not that bikes shouldn't be cheaper. They should absolutely be cheaper if they can be. But it's like, man, what were you guys doing before? There's a lot of questions, and there's a lot of people that are very angry at them. We're pretty indifferent at this point as a dealer. But we're talking about like an S-Works going from $15,500 to $11,000. Like, oh, it's overnight. Let's make it $4,000 cheaper. It's like, what the fuck are you guys doing?
Like, did they give what you were you doing before? What are you doing now? So that you can make that money back?
Well, it's probably not good to get into all the politics because it's not going to go anywhere good.
No,
it's not going to go anywhere good.
They are offering that. There's a bunch of hoops to jump through, but it's possible to get a.
Well, also, most dealers, including ourselves, will not be made whole on it at all because, yeah, it's probably not wise to get into all of the nooks and crannies of this. Just know that, I mean, Specialized is clearly taking a big hit on this, right? It's not like just the dealers are getting hurt, if you will. But, I mean, this blindsided dealers and dealers committed to big amounts of bikes and big dollars. And then they're just like, oh, just kidding. We're just going to make them a ton cheaper. So, yeah, it's fairly controversial. Maybe it's the right decision in the long term. But, man, I just feel like they've been going guardrail to guardrail on a lot of decisions lately. Everything is very short-sighted. It's just my opinion. But, yeah, we should probably stop it there. Yeah. Consumers can make the decision for themselves. I think ultimately, like I said, I think it's probably good in the long term. And that's all I'm going to say about that.
All right.
Did you guys see that Linsky filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy?
Oh, yeah.
Linsky, there were a lot of other like weird ties in there. Maybe Linsky was providing raw materials to somebody else or maybe vice versa. And they were maybe involved in some other stuff, not like bad stuff, just involved in other industries. And yeah, that was the vibe I got many, many years ago because Linsky was much more popular in Tennessee because they were based out of Tennessee, were they not?
Yeah.
I think somewhere maybe Knoxville area.
I like in this article, it says court filings show that Linsky has between $1 million and $10 million in debt. Like, well,
no, that's a
pretty big gap.
I don't think so. So I think the court filing just has to say, I think that court filing comes down to.
Yeah, maybe you just pick a window.
Exactly. Yeah. Kenny filled in my blank. Like, we have, you know, $500 million or more in debt. That's handled in a certain way. We have,
there's probably very different things you got to do. Like, oh, yeah, we're $10,000 in debt. Versus we're $6 billion in debt.
Right. And I think that that's just like a legal window, checkbox, whatever you want to call it. I don't know. I can't say that I'm surprised. Their bikes are always on sale. And I spend a good bit of time on Reddit. I think it's cool because I get to learn stuff. And a lot of people are asking a lot of questions on there. And I can either learn about things I don't know about or, you know, help in on the things that I do know. And yeah, I think that's a pretty cool place. But there's been a lot of people that with chatter of like, hey, I ordered this bike in September and it hasn't landed yet. And I haven't heard from them in weeks. And the one thing that I'll really say here is like Linsky is blaming Shopify and they said egregious chargebacks. Like, dude, if you change my delivery date on my bicycle 6 times and I have the receipts, you know, like I have emails where you've told me like, oh, this bike will ship in 2 weeks. And then a month later, you're like, this bike will ship in a month. And then a month later, you're like, this bike will ship in a month. That's not an egregious chargeback. That's a fuck you. Give me my money or my bicycle. And yeah.
Yeah. Chargebacks are one of those things where we have so few chargebacks as a company that when we do get them, they're very painful because you know, you feel responsible and you want to know what happened. And a lot of times we feel like we're not the ones at fault, and some customer just uses the strength of the consumer credit card network and just says like, oh yeah, they'll do stuff like they'll buy a bike from us and then still possess the bike and then do a chargeback. It's like, yo, you flip the, they can't do that. Like, that's theft at that point. So it's that kind of stuff where chargebacks can be painful. And I get it, especially if you're doing a lot of primarily online business, you're going to get chargebacks, whether they're right or wrong. And that's the cost of doing business. If you're going to be primarily an online retailer, it's just going to happen. So I would also agree that there's probably some other part of that story there. If you're just getting an insane number of chargebacks, you're sorry, but you're probably fucking up. Like, you as a retailer are fucking up.
No.
I don't think it's a grand consumer conspiracy to take down Linsky.
Yeah, and like, they also were citing a part shortage, but every part is available right now. So the only way parts aren't available is if you can't afford them. And I have no insider knowledge on this case, but I know that certain bicycle brands, like, not just bicycle brands, customers of vendors, customers in like the bike shop or brand level, are not extended credit terms with certain distributors after they do not make good on a certain amount of, you know, if you always pay your bill late, then you start to have to pay that stuff when you buy it, not when you ship it. And then that starts to, when that starts to happen, though, things start spiraling the drain, because it, at the level that they buy things, that they being all OEs, you know, original equipment, like, you know, that'd be a bike brand. They don't have the time to buy your parts when you buy your bike. They have to forecast that and then buy those parts. And then they get the order and they have the parts that they've gotten at amazing pricing with dating, because both parties know that we need X amount of leadway from Taiwan to get you these parts. So you don't have to pay for them immediately, because you'd be paying for them before you even own them or could sell them or whatever. And you don't even have to pay on delivery. You need to pay X amount of days later. And when you don't pay those bills, you go to a cash account. And then you are in a situation where you're paying for that stuff early. And then it just, like, bad things start happening. So I don't know that they were on a cash account basis with SRAM, FSA, who else is in here? There's 200 plus creditors, but I think what you need to understand there is 200 plus creditors could include, you know, I'm just going to throw out some like names here. Like, they might order their frames from company A. They probably order headset spacers from company B, because they don't need to buy problem solvers headset spacers. They just buy headset spacers from Taiwan. They're already a bike brand. They shop in Taiwan. They know how to do that. They may owe DHL money. They may owe FedEx money. They may owe, you know, 200 plus creditors could include their garbage disposal company. They could owe their box vendor. They could owe their bubble vendor, or, you know, packing foam vendor. There's all the, like, so 200 plus creditors seems like really egregious, but if you start thinking about, like, a savvy business isn't just going to go to, oh, I don't know, you know, Shipping Depot and buy boxes and foam. They're going to have a box supplier. They're going to have a foam supplier. They're going to have a headset spacer. And they may be using something as simple as, like, McMaster Car and ordering water bottle bolts. So, like, you could easily end up with a ton of places you owe a little to a lot of money. Yeah, like, the reason that I'm bringing up the 200 plus is it becomes systemic when you're not paying your trash bill so you can order headset spacers, and then you don't pay your headset guy so you can finally get your trash picked up, and then, yeah, it's just gnarly, so.
All right, can I do just a quick one?
Oh, God, I wanted to talk about that one, too.
Drift enters the mountain bike scene with the ARC waterproof clip in shoe. Mm-hmm. So I don't know anything about this company.
I don't either.
I just want to say that if you have a shoe that is waterproof,
it should be more than 3 inches tall.
If the distance between the bottom of your foot and the lowest part of the shoe, like, say, right around your ankle bone, is only a few inches, that shoe is not actually water. Like, the outside of the shoe might, yes, it is technically waterproof. I don't know how many of you have gone through, say, a mud puddle or a creek and had the water or mud, kind of liquidy mud, like splash on you. It goes in the top of the shoe. That shoe is now waterproof from the inside also. So you have like a little lake around your foot.
So I'm going to interrupt you only to read the only bike rumor comment from a wonderful person named Owen. Ah, yes. The waterproof mountain bike shoe. Let's water running through the top from splashes, water running down your leg or rain. Then it can't get back out due to the wonderful waterproof lining. Why are these type of waterproof shoes still being made? A waterproof boot with a high ceiling cuff? Yes, fine, but not a shoe.
And that's exactly what I'm saying.
Like, it doesn't even have an ankle gaiter. Like,
yeah, I told someone I did. So that's another thing I did this week. I took one of the guys at the gun shop that I talk to just about every time I'm in there. His lady friend wanted to learn how to turkey hunt and wanted to go turkey hunting. And she got her hunter's education. She bought a tag and he messaged me. I was like, cool. You know, if you guys need any advice, like of where to go or whatever, because I wasn't sure like how much turkey hunting he'd done in the area. And, just let me know. He messages me one day. He's like, hey, could you take her turkey hunting? And I get it. You know, I don't fault anyone in a relationship for not wanting to be the teacher in a relationship, because that oftentimes, even if you have a great relationship, that oftentimes just doesn't work that well, because some people are just bad teachers. I'm not that great of a teacher. And, you know, so I took her turkey hunting and I told her, look, anytime I give you some advice, just little stuff, it's because I fucked it up real bad a few times and figured it out. And I'm just letting you know, like, this stuff, so you don't have to do that. Stuff like if you are walking through the woods and you, like, have to snap a branch off a tree, close your fucking eyes when you snap the branch off the tree, because parts of that tree are going to hit you in the face. And yeah, it's like, ask me how I know. And so yeah, like, I learned this lesson about waterproof shoes a long time ago when I decided I was going to try trail running. And I was like, waterproof shoes. That's trail running shoes, just a low cut sneaker with a lot of tread and it's waterproof. Cool. And the first time I went through a puddle, my shoe just filled up with water that stayed there until I took the shoe off and dumped it out. Like, wow, that was terrible. So, yeah, like the commenter on Bike Rumor said, if you have something that's tall or you have a gaiter or something, that's great. Something that's going to keep the water from getting straight into the top of your shoe, then a waterproof shoe is great. But something that is very low cut around your ankle, yeah, the water is just going to go into your shoe from that way, not through the toe. I mean, sure, otherwise they look like just a nice, whatever, kind of downhill style clip-in shoe, but don't get these because they're waterproof. What else do you guys have?
Let's see.
Kenny, have you seen the Bosch over the air update?
I sure have.
That looks pretty cool.
Yeah, it's just a lot of people being reactionary, whether it's right or wrong, to Avanox.
Yeah.
It's pretty wild.
Let's see. RMU launched their Night Train high idler bike. Thing's got a bunch of pivots. So many pivots.
Yeah, that's kind of wild looking.
Like, there's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Yeah, 6 pivots, at least 12 bearings, and a high idler. And yeah, there's just a lot going on there.
I want to know what drivetrain is on that bike. It's got a wire going to the rear derailleur, but that's not an e-bike.
That looks like Link Glide.
I know, but why does it have a Is that one of those tiny little shift housings, like cable housings?
No, I think it's normal size cable housing. It just looks funny. You don't run shifters with that stuff. You only run droppers with that 0.8 cable.
That's what I thought, but that definitely looks smaller, but maybe it's just the way the picture is.
Yeah. It looks cool. I think. I don't know.
If you want to see something that looks fucking weird slash cool.
The Aeon?
The Aeon.
Yeah, that is weird looking. That top tube is just open.
Yeah, I mean, it's reasonable. I think something like this could work in theory. What's interesting, if you look at a dirt bike chassis with no plastics and no gas tank and stuff on it, it doesn't look super dissimilar to something like this. I think you can make it work from an engineering standpoint. Now, I would also ask a little bit maybe why, but the rest of the bike's kind of neat. It's got some maybe moto-inspired looking stuff. It's got a Gates belt drive, which I still think is a very bad idea on a bicycle, because this system that they have here could very easily be a chain.
Well, have you seen...
And it would be simpler and lighter.
Have you seen what Gates is offering on the downhill circuit?
I know. They've been offering like $100,000 if you win a DH World Cup or something like that on a Gates belt drive, which is fine. Maybe that's why they're trying to do it.
That's what I would assume, because I don't know any other reason why you would want that.
But I think it's cool. I like some out-of-the-box thinking.
Got that direct mount sort of stem thing going on?
Yeah, we got that much higher than normal stem. I think we're going to see a lot more of that. I think bicycles with stems out over the front of the wheel, I think that kind of stuff is going to slowly go away. That's my educated guess.
I mean, but define over the wheel.
Any stem that's not one in this picture.
Exactly.
Just sticking straight up at your face at the same angle as the fork.
Okay.
Or the hip tube.
I think your bar roughly following the line of your fork, the imaginary line of your fork that continues upwards.
Okay.
You think just as reaches get longer, that stems are just going to start being just your bars are just on top of your fork or your head tube?
I think they're just going to figure out what Moto has figured out. That's my educated guess. Now, granted, there's different things. You have to pedal a bicycle, so there's compromises that had to be made. But I think people are going to start to tolerate longer and longer wheelbases. And I think this is going to start to work. That's my guess.
All right.
Okay.
That's all I've got. We had a few listener questions.
Pull them up.
All right, let's do them. We haven't done any in a while.
From Jeff, Single Speed Outlaw says, please explain O-chain like I'm 5 years old. Last week we had talked about how SRAM is improving the engineering, or I guess the design on the O-chain to make it a little bit more robust. But we didn't really go into what O-chain was.
Okay, I'm going to do my best. Bike has suspension. As the suspension moves, the distance from the center of the bottom bracket to the center of
the rear wheel stuff we're talking about here.
Yep. So from the center of the bottom bracket to the center of the rear axle, sometimes that has to get a little bit longer. Sometimes when getting longer, pedal want to move backwards, feel harsh.
It's because your pedals are fixed. You're in your attack position. You're not pedaling. Your pedals are fixed, and you're in your whatever you want to call that position, right? Like you're
kind of braced against your pedals.
You're six and you're 12. You're one and you're six. However you want to do that on your
three
clock
and
face,
nine,
right? But great. You're in your just normal attack position, level pedals on the ground.
Wait, Kenny, do you descend at 12 and six?
Well, I mean, it depends on how you look at your clock.
You said one and six. That's what I was wondering.
Like, yeah, do you have your fucking...
What kind of crank do you have?
Did you put your dub cranks on?
Power cranks
one off?
Like, triathletes would use where, like...
Yeah,
where if you don't pedal right, your pedals both, like, fall down to the bottom of the pedal stroke.
I just put them on however they go on. It's fine. But yeah, you're not pedaling. Your suspension's moving and doing suspension things. It tries to make your chain longer. Your chain, something's got to give because your fucking chain's getting longer. And so that feedback then tries to make your pedals go backwards.
And people call it pedal kickback.
Pedal kickback. It does two things. One, it kicks your feet and it makes your feet feel funky and it adds harshness to the whole system. And as that whole thing tightens up, it makes your rear suspension also not want to go through its travel how it should.
Continue. You covered it. So, and this is just a damper inside of the spider that helps isolate.
So it lets
that.
Things stretch more.
Yeah.
It lets shit stretch. And in this case, it's letting your drivetrain take up some of that tension or relieve some of that tension, however you want to look at it. And so you either do it in your hub, like E13 and DT Swiss and a few other people have tried to do, or you do it in your chainring, like O-Chain is trying to do. Or you just choose not to run a very high engagement hub. So the higher engagement hub you run, there's less slack in that whole system, and that gets to your feet faster. So if you run really, really low engagement hubs, you're less likely to feel pedal kickback.
Yeah, and the only problem with the hubs is you can still, I mean, obviously it's going to become like a little bit of a lottery. But you,
it's a game of chance
yeah.
on where you are in that system.
Yeah, because if you almost have, like if you're about to engage on the previous paw, like backpedaling, you've got a ton of room to move for the wheel to move. If you're about to engage on the one you're in, you know, the next one, like if you're moving forward, then it might kick back.
So to prevent that, you either do a high pivot bike or some other out of the box suspension design, or if you like a traditional suspension design, if you will, then you got to do it somewhere else. So you run an O-chain. And there you go.
Okay. So next question from Axel. We actually have two questions. The first one, today's show brought up a question I had about front fork axles. You were discussing Maxle with a little handle. I had one on my old bike, which had a RockShox fork. My current bikes are both Fox 35 Rhythm. Now they come without the handle. Is it necessary to get a Fox axle, or can I use a Maxle?
Not cross-compatible.
The thread pitches are different.
And if you would probably need to buy the, let's see, Fox, what is that thing called? It's not the Cobalt, is it? No, the Cobalt is the...
I think it's just called the Cobalt. Cobalt, I think, just means no lever on it.
It's just a axle assembly is what they call it when it is not. A Cobalt is the bolt-on style. He wants one with a lever.
Yeah, and you would need to make sure
I don't know what the fuck they actually call that.
Yeah, I think they have some different lengths of those, so you just need to make sure that you get the correct length for your fork. And so the part that the fork, on a Fox fork, the part that is threaded on your dropouts, if you have a Cobalt, that's just like a little aluminum, I don't know, nub threaded insert that's in there. And it doesn't have any sort of like detents or anything where you can change where it sits in the fork. If you have the lever type, it's going to have an adjustment on the threaded side where that insert is, where you can remove that insert and rotate it. So that when you close your through axle, the lever is in the position that you want. It's not like sticking out the front or hanging down the bottom or whatever, but you need both of those. You would need the proper length through axle with the handle, and then you would also need that little small part that is it has some numbers on it. You would need that to put on the threaded side.
It's just the axle nut, and you can just rotate that nut in the fork.
Yeah.
I think they call
it... What's the version... Who makes the axle that's adjustable?
So Fox makes two levered through axles. They make one that you use a 4mm. So what you're talking about is they have the weirdest names for things. So moving back, if we look at the original through axle with a lever, it used the QR15 geared cam and hardware. That's the name for it. And that allows you to adjust the position of the lever, because even though everything is supposed to be 15 by 110, if you have a 15 by 109.5 versus a 15.110.2, it's all going to line up a little bit differently in where that axle handle clocks. And you need the QR15 geared cam and hardware for the type Andrea was discussing. They did release the adjustable through axle.
I forgot about that one.
That one is insanely heavy. It is like really, really heavy. I'm looking for it. And because none of their names are like easy for me to remember, I can't find it right off the top of my, or with this quick Googling. But yeah, that one is really, really heavy. So I don't know. I would try to find the original one and then get that cammed nut. So,
and you got to be a little careful, because I want to say, and you guys can correct me if I'm wrong, but any of the Foxes that have a pinch bolt in the bottom, it has another different axle, unfortunately.
Mm-hmm. I don't think Marzocchi has any pinch bolt stuff.
Oh, is that what he has?
Yes.
Okay.
No, he has a Rhythm 34.
Got it. So, well, he's probably okay.
He's got a 34 or a 36. He said a Fox 35 Rhythm, which...
That's not a...
Sorry, Axel. Oh, we're talking about axles with Axel. Jesus Christ, I'm such a nerd. Yeah, that it doesn't do. There ain't no 35 Fox. Make sure you don't have a Fox or a RockShox with a bunch of Fox stickers on it. I'm just kidding.
All right, and his other question... I had another question about bikes. My newest bike has a flat top chain. I have an old chain checker tool I picked up maybe 10 years ago. Is there a flat top chain specific tool, or is it possible to still use the old one?
There's a specific tool. You measure chain wear on a flat top chain differently than on the old chains. Unfortunately, that's my only gripe, so...
Isn't it more of like a side-to-side
flex? You're checking the like flexibility of the chain, not necessarily the stretch of the chain.
Yeah, so it's going to be like roller wear, like, I don't know how to explain it really, but basically your chain will get more side-to-side play before it's stretched to. Your chain checker probably says like 0.5 and 0.75 or 0.75 and 1. If you have a chain checker that has... I know like Unior, they make one that's will measure like a little bit more, like it actually shows you where the chain is stretched like lengthwise, and it'll measure down to like, I don't know, 0.25 or something. I have found that at least with like a SRAM Eagle, like before flat top chains existed, when they get to about 0.25, you're getting the same, I guess, degradation in shift performance that you would see in an older chain at 0.75. And that's just based on measuring a lot of chains and shifting a lot of bikes. That's not a scientific thing, but it's something that I look at like in the bike shop, because I don't have like the side-to-side measurement tool. If I have a 12-speed drivetrain and I measure the chain with like the Unior tool and it says like 0.25, 0.3, that's when I'm like, you probably need a new chain. And most of the time the shifting's a little slow, especially on like the gears they use the most. That's just my like anecdotal educated finding. You know, if you don't have the side-to-side chain checker, you know, if you're going to buy a new chain checker, just go ahead and look for one that's made for that chain. But otherwise, you can kind of make a very educated guess based on measurement of length. And we got one more. This is from Bill. Bill says, "Hey, y'all, longtime listener, first time caller. Everyone and their sister knows about Shimano's wandering bite point problem on previous generation brakes. Do y'all have any experience with the new Shimano brakes? I'm specifically looking at the new XTR M922, 9...
9220.
9220, sorry. My brain just quit there.
We all heard.
The four piston brakes. Love Taylor Swift. Yes. Bring back Kenny's How to Drive a Fucking Car segment.
While Andrew was trying to read that number, there was just a potato rotating in the microwave.
It was. It was rotating and it was sizzling like it was about to explode. So, either of you, I haven't had my hands on them other than the one demo that the rep brought by the shop.
Yeah, it's kind of funny. They've been out for a long time now. We had a couple people who are just diehard Shimano fans that bought them right off the hop. So, we've sold, I don't know, 2, 3, 4 sets in the aftermarket. I've maybe was involved in setting up one of them. And that, you know, pulling them, they feel okay, if not like a little bit squishy. But until you get heat in them, you really can't explore the wandering bite point thing. Like, you got to ride it on a trail. Even a parking lot's really not going to probably give you the best idea of what's going on. So I wish I had more feedback, but so few people run those brakes and almost no bikes are spec'd with those brakes. They specifically said they were trying to address the wandering bite point thing, and Shimano acknowledged that that was a thing probably for the first time in 20 years. And it's been a thing for 20 years. But I just don't know. So few bikes run them. We talk so much shit on Shimano because they don't make good products anymore. But I would just be very scared. Like, why get that brake? Why? I think there's just so many other good options on the market right now.
Yeah, I mean, if you get a...
And that one is so unproven and it runs way different oil and all the other stuff. And I'm sorry, but at this point, until it proves itself, I'm not interested.
Yeah, if you just... got a bike that has those on it from the factory, then I would ride it and see and get back to us.
That's the only time. I'm glad you brought that up, Andrea. Yeah. That's the only time, in my opinion, that you should ride those brakes. If your new bike that you love came with those brakes, then phenomenal. Run those brakes. You're going to learn about them. But spending your hard-earned money to buy aftermarket, very much question mark, new Shimano thin oil brakes, why would you do that?
Yeah, I wouldn't just buy them just to buy them. I'd, look at something else. If you don't like SRAM, I don't know, maybe look at like the TRPs that Kenny likes or anything else.
Anything else. I'm sorry, but yeah, anything else. Most of the SRAM lineup is pretty darn hashed out these days. I personally like the TRPs. I understand why people might not like them. They are not without fault. You could get a bad one out of the box like I did one time, but I think longevity-wise, I haven't seen a whole lot of TRP problems. Maybe other people have. Yeah, I really haven't.
Other than like some really clapped out like entry-level OE brakes that are, like 5 or 6 years old. Like, I haven't seen any that are like kind of new and are leaking out of the levers or anything. So there's that.
I'm not trying to be funny. I truly think you would be better off if you really want something Shimano. You're better off buying MT200s than you are XTRs.
That way, if it does start to leak, it's cheap to replace.
Well, they're less likely to leak, and they cost $50. And we put on a ridiculous number of MT200s every day.
Yeah.
And I definitely have seen old, clapped out, leaking MT200s, but I think I see less of those than I do their higher end brakes.
All right.
Yep. All right. Well, that's all I got. You guys ready to wrap it up?
No, we need Kenny's How to Drive segment.
Oh, yeah. Kenny, how do you drive a fucking car?
Okay, I got my list pulled up here. I don't remember which episode we left off on. I'll just do one today. Tonight's segment of How to Drive a Fucking Car is brought to you by the Russian left turn. And the Russian left turn is when you are either in the middle lane or right lane and you start to turn right, and then you swerve across all said lanes of traffic, and you don't even do a U-turn. You just decide to make a left-hand turn from the right lane and you take out the people in the left lane and the middle lane. It's a pretty ridiculous move.
Yeah. I can see that.
So there we go. I see probably one a week. Not kidding. It's insane. The amount of shit that I see in Utah is mind-blowing, and shit's only getting worse, I feel like. There is a stop sign. I know I said I was doing one segment, but now I'm just going to kind of talk about stuff in general. There's a stop sign right by my work. It's a fairly busy intersection, but not like incredibly busy. It's just a normal four-way stop. There's typically 1 to 2 people in queue at almost all times. So kind of that busy. And I think pretty much once a week now for about 3 to 4 months, somebody rips through there at 60 miles an hour. It's a 35 mile an hour speed limit. So not only do they blow the stop sign, but they're like egregiously speeding.
They're doubling the speed
limit. And absolutely someone's going to fucking die there. It's crazy. Yeah. I mean, the last person that did it was today. And myself, luckily, I'm like looking around and I'm ready to go. And here comes this motherfucker just barreling down the road, clearly not stopping. So like I hesitate. He absolutely blows the stop sign. And me and like 6 other people are just laying on the horn. So there's like all of this going on. And the guy didn't even check up after all that shit. Like, what in the flying fuck could you possibly be doing that after you already completely fucked up and almost killed many people and you get all that feedback of like 6 car horns blaring at you and you don't even check up? Are you fucking kidding me?
Kenny, you know what it is. I think vehicles now are so insulated from everything. You've got like lane departure warnings. You've got some with like some self-driving features. You've got like, and there's like so much, you like that guy might have not heard 6 car horns blaring at him, especially, you know, if there's some music playing or something. Like, you are so insulated from everything and you can't see shit because everything's tall. And I don't know, like, I think that if more people drove like manual transmissions with, instead of an airbag, you just have like a spike sticking out of your steering
Kenny's
wheel.
Kenny's brought that up before. Everyone's first car should
I've brought it up 100%. Yeah, everyone's first car should be like a manual single turbo 800 horsepower rear-wheel drive Supra. Like, that's what you fucking drive. And yeah, fucking power comes on in a fucking lump at 5,000 RPMs and it just blows the rear tires loose every time. And it'll get people's fucking attention. And no ABS. And obviously no other driver aids.
Yeah.
And people need to learn how to fucking drive again. Like, god damn it. What's also insane is not only did he blow the stop sign, but there are literally people all around him in every other direction that he's in, other than unfortunately his lane. But the other 3 directions, there are people fucking stopped. Would you not be like, huh, what's going on here? Even if you somehow didn't see the stop sign.
No.
The other thing that's impressive about this piece is this stop sign is right after a lighted intersection. It's like 50 yards after it.
So he was doing like a drag race by himself to
I don't
go
know.
Through the
no
stop
fucking
sign.
Idea. I mean, I'm not saying it's possible that he had a green light and he, you know, went through it, but there's like another intersection right back there. It's not like you're in the middle of nowhere and the road's been straight and you've been going 60 miles an hour forever, and then there's like a stop sign that's like kind of hidden behind a tree. Like, I kind of get that you could maybe miss that. This is like everything is so segmented, it's just mind-blowing that you could fuck this up. And a lot of people have fucked this one up. And it's also in multiple directions. It's not like one of these stop signs is obscured by a tree branch or something. It's every single conceivable direction of this intersection. I have seen people just full on not even check up, blow through it. So it's insane. There's something in the water, like legitimately something in the water. You can actually read a news article on it. I saw the headline. I did not actually watch the video because I can't look at news sites on my phone because it overheats and crashes because news sites fucking blow, every single goddamn last one of them. But anyway, they did an article on 123rd in Draper in Utah that I think they had 10 injury accidents in and around that road in the last week. And they're asking, like, what the fuck are you guys doing? And so I'm asking, what the fuck are you guys doing?
Yeah.
Anyway, that's it. That's my driving segment.
All right. Let's read patrons and wrap it up. So our patrons starting at $10 per month, who got Kurt, Skunk in Your Trap, Jim the Fucked Up Trike Guy, Burt Reynolds Krusty Stash, Zozo, Eric, Burt Reynolds Mustache, Taperboard Pro, My Pal Dal, MTB Shenanigans, increased my level again to allow unhinged names like
Mike Jones,
Cam Irish One, Tennessee Zach, Green Giant, AJ, Leland, Mista Bombastic, Ride Time Extended, JC, Gordon, Josh, Josh, Fart Noises, Chipset Coffee, We Caffeinate Colorado, Ryan, Bill, Aaron, Che King, The Caffeine Queen, Ty, Noah, Cool Beans.
Ooh, she nasty.
No, my name is Clayton, Frank the Tank, Goat Roper, Balls, Professor XXX, at $11.11 per month, Howie Do It, Patamelon Disco Ball at $14 Australian, and at $20 a month, Ridge Runout Gravel, presented by Andrea's Hormoning Podcast, Scott, Joe, I Want a Mustache Ride from Burt Reynolds, Poop Wrench, and at $26.06 per month. This has to be something about the specialized command post.
The Clit Annihilator 5000 dropper post, now with 666% more return speed.
At $26.06 per month. Harley at 30, Troy at 31, and Six Pack Outdoors, purveyors of top shelf shenanigans and cycling events at 50.
All right.
I don't know how many of our listeners have ridden a specialized command post with a little too much air in it.
Not enough.
Or, you know, Wolftooths, I don't know if they are still like this, but if you had too much air in those, that return speed
was a little bit,
not quite as violent as the command post.
No, the Wolftooth was like shooting like a 410 that wasn't properly shouldered, and the command post, when inflated to its max pressure, was like shooting turkey loads, both barrels.
Yeah.
I've had a command post hit me in the nuts before.
Who amongst us hasn't?
Yeah, like you're doing the hover, and you think you're at the right height to receive the saddle, you know, where it just...
You made Matt just took a drink of water and spit it back out when you said that.
Yeah, I had to looking at all this electronic equipment, I made the decision to just dribble all the water out of my mouth back into my Nalgene, so thanks, Kenny.
But... if you are at the correct height to receive the saddle, minus a half of an inch, the first thing in the line of fire are your nuts.
And the best part is if you try to do that twice in one ride, you can't, because when it hits you in the nuts, they like flip up over your penis and like tangle up.
Yeah. So yeah, those things were gnarly. But you can bring them back to life pretty easy. You just, you take a screwdriver and you bend over the collar, because they usually unthread. You just smash it with a screwdriver and put a detent in it. And you slap some TriFlow on the stanchion and put some air in that chamber, and that bitch is going to work.
It does. No lies detected.
The best part is one of the dudes at the shop, his sister doesn't mountain bike a ton, and she has a bike with a command post. And he's like, it just won't quit working. He's like, every time I see it, I like pull up the seal head and I like clean it out a little bit, put a little slick honey in it, and clean the stanchion off, and like it just keeps going.
They will last a long time.
Unlike your nuts.
Because there are no parts in it. It is an air spring. That is it.
All right. Well,
let's shut it down.
Okay. Thank you all for listening, and good night.
Bye. Thanks for tuning in to the Just Riding Along Show.
There's some shit coming out of your pants.